The following content is intended for people who are blind or Brent impaired.
Engage.
You are listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. I'm Chris Skidmore, and this is Tech Tips. When you think of games, and especially video games, you don't necessarily think of people who are blind or have low vision playing them. Well, that's just not the case. This month, we are going to be talking with Gary Bartos and Matthew Schifrin about accessible gaming. That's what's coming up this month on Tech Tips. If you're old enough to recognize that sound, don't forget to schedule your next colonoscopy. In November of 1972, Pong was released and the video game industry was born. In 1980, we got probably the most recognizable tune of all time from the video game Pac-Man. Fast forward another 40 plus years and video games are quite literally everywhere. Although making mainstream games accessible was not on anybody's radar at first, nowadays making games accessible is almost a must. While huge strides have been made in this area, there is still lots of room for improvement. This month, we are talking with Gary Bartos and Matthew Schifrin about accessible gaming. Hey guys, thanks for joining me today and welcome to Tech Tips.
Great to be here.
Thank you.
So right off the bat, first of all, thank you both for your time. It is greatly appreciated. And let's just dive right in. This is going to be our first kind of jump ball question, and it is, who is Gary Bartos and Matthew Schifrin?
Well, I am not Gary Bartos. That is an important distinction to make. I am Matthew Schifrin, and I run a nonprofit called Bricks for the Blind. And Bricks for the Blind creates text-based building instructions that enable blind, visually impaired, and deafblind people to build Lego sets on their own.
Nice. Gary, what about you?
Matt's leaving a lot out there.
But... Oh, well, okay. Matthew, you continue, man.
I write musicals. I'm a professional accordionist and countertenor, which is a guy who sings very high. I also created Braille for Yiddish because Yiddish had no Braille, and now it does. And that's it for now.
That's it for now. You've done a lot.
I tried. It's good to do a lot rather than a little.
You are so correct in that. Gary, how about you?
I've worked in artificial vision, machine vision, and computer vision for 30 years. It'll be 30 years this fall. Most of that time in industrial work, automation, making cars, computers, planes, all that sort of thing. So that's digital cameras and 3D sensors. But to get back more to the topic of the day here, so I grew up in Rochester, Michigan. That's the home of Leader Dogs for the Blind. So when I was a young boy, sitting in the donut shop looking outside, I could actually see orientation and mobility instruction taking place, which had an impact on me. So personally, I do not qualify as legally as having a visual impairment, as a vision impairment, but I have strabismus. So one of my eyes turns out, it's exotropic, it's very noticeable. I'm stereo blind, so I'm mostly typically sighted, but I look different. Occasionally I have problems with depth perception. And more recently, Matt doesn't know this yet, I've started to talk about things I hadn't talked about before, including I have a sensitivity to too much visual and auditory information. It's great. Okay. I can process it. So there's that. And so I come in with a little bit of, like, I would say my toe in the community of people with disabilities. There are others. I'm getting old.
Like a friend of ours says, getting old, it ain't for the weak.
No.
And let's just keep the jump ball questions going. How did you guys get into gaming?
My family, and going back some generations, is a sports, and you can include gaming, family. My older siblings and I are Gen Xers, so that would be, you know, like 60s through the late 70s. Mm-hmm. So those are the peak arcade years when we were an age where we could play these games. So I grew up with Pong, Atari, Pac-Man, the earliest handheld games with LED displays where they would just light up one LED at a time. That's supposed to convey a sense of motion.
God, I'd forgotten about those.
Yes, football was the big one.
Yes.
Yes.
And once you learned the pattern, you could run 1,000 yards at a time and never get tackled.
Yes. You just keep going. Keep going. So yeah, you know, and I'll say, so I grew up in this competitive household. Playing video games was fine just because where I grew up, ball sports were important. That was just part of growing up. But one of the reasons I got more into board gaming and video gaming and stuff like that is I could play these ball sports with my friends up to a certain age. But then there's a certain point I couldn't catch the ball, you know, all of a sudden, but you have this kind of impairment, then it becomes really difficult. So effectively, you just stop. That's kind of how I got into gaming. I mean, grew up with it. We had this stuff at home when it became available. We went to the arcade, Atari, Centipede.
Oh,
all
yeah.
These classic games. Yeah, I grew up with those.
Yeah, I grew up pretty much the same way. Matthew, how about you?
I'm younger than Gary, but I'm blind myself. And there are Braille board games, and they're great. And there were also audio games you could play on a computer that blind people made for blind people. And some of them were very interesting. There was Metris, for example, and that was musical Tetris. And it was interesting because you had these different notes falling from the top of the screen to the bottom, and they were kind of higher or lower in your headphones, and you had to make different chords or scales or whatever. And the thing with all these games was that, at least the audio ones, they were a decade behind what was happening in video games at the time. From a board game standpoint, I had Braille board games that a friend of mine was able to Braille, mostly word games. From a video game standpoint, I know blind people who were able to memorize entire maps in games like Pokemon, and they were able to battle other people and beat these games because they were able to memorize all the different sounds that these various Pokemon would make. I was never at that level, and it just wasn't really a part of the culture around me. I had friends who played, and that was great. But when I was growing up, these games were not particularly accessible. Even if they were, you'd have to have a friend narrating stuff, and it was difficult. Then again, that's just me. I know blind people who are a little bit older who had brothers and sisters, and gaming was very much a part of it. And they'd sit down with their brother who would read all the dialogue options and help them out with levels. So there are definitely blind people who are very into video games. I was just not one of them. Seeing the accessibility and various leaps and bounds that have happened with video games, I think if I were growing up now, I would definitely be more of a PC gamer or a console person.
It is amazing to me how far accessible gaming has come over the years. And it does kind of lead into the next question. What makes a game, and I realize this is a huge question, what makes a game accessible and why does it matter?
To put it simply, 1 in 4 people have a disability of some sort. And it matters because if you want them to be able to play your game and buy your game and enjoy your game, then you need to take certain considerations into account to make sure that these people with various disabilities, be they blind or neurodivergent or part of hearing or have a mobility impairment or whatever, can play your game. It's also very important just from a social inclusion standpoint, in the sense the fact that the disabled person is able to play against and beat the stuffing out of their able-bodied colleagues is a wonderful feeling.
Most definitely.
So Matt and I talk about this, and we talk to people. Accessibility is a right. Mm-hmm. And if accessibility is a right, then accessibility should be universal. So Matt talked about the different kinds of disabilities. You just think of, go through a list of all the different disabilities. That includes cognitive disabilities, social disabilities, hearing, vision, movement, mental health, communication, all these sorts of things. If you have that in mind, that is, everybody should be able to play this game and enjoy it and, like Matt said, have a chance to just beat the pants off somebody.
Exactly.
Then it has to be an equitable experience.
Mm-hmm.
And so accessible gaming, think in terms of universal accessible gaming, anybody can play the same game. It'd be nice if it was a popular game, just making sure that everyone can play. And then that implies certain things about where you get in the design process, the impact we can have talking to people. That's where we have, I think, the most impact.
How did we get to this point? How has accessibility in games evolved?
If we're thinking about accessibility in video games, it's evolved through efforts by these kind of trailblazers in the video game space. Steve Saylor, Ross Miner, the late Brendan Cole, Janissary, who is a video game audio description writer. These people who are not only consultants, not only experts, but they are the ones who want to play the games and enjoy the games. And so they're the ones who are writing to the companies and being very, very practical with their advice. But it's not only them. It is also the blind and visually impaired or sometimes sighted modification programmer people who take a game like, for example, Factorio, which is a grid-based factory making resource management behemoth of a game. And they're able to make it so accessible that a blind person is able to play it on his own. But not only are they able to make it accessible, but they have created a whole tutorial specifically designed for the blind player. It guides you through all the shortcuts and explains how to simplify the process so that you can play near the speed or possibly at the speed of a sighted person. Video game accessibility in the blind and visually impaired landscape has happened because of the people who made it happen.
If you would, let's talk a little bit about what actually makes a game accessible. Is it the controllers? Is it the display settings? What is it? And at the same time, what are some of the most common complaints about why a game is inaccessible?
You need to be able to access the menus. For example, screen readers. Consoles have built-in screen readers. That's great. But the game must also support these screen readers and leverage the screen readers. Then come the actual settings so that the game can be played. For example, auditory waypoints that make sounds so that you're able to follow them to your next objective. Automatic aiming, sound cues for when your health gets low, when an enemy is about to attack you. Very specific 3D sounds so that you can figure out exactly where enemies are around you. Inventory management and menus within the game that are read. Tooltips and tutorial text that is read. Accessible maps and points where you can basically fast travel to different locations and ways to drop waypoints so that you know where you are and where you're off to. Those are features. But when we think about visual impairment, things such as high contrast and things of that nature, but also very adjustable difficulty levels so that you can say, hey, I don't want these enemies to attack me at all, or puzzles. If a puzzle is inaccessible, offering skip options so that you can just skip it, for example.
Colors. It's another big one for people who are colorblind, so sighted but colorblind, which is a huge group.
Yeah, yeah.
So color choice is just a few tweaks. And so that's an example of dual coding, having multiple types of feedback. Depending on the game, it could be a connection through something like an iPhone so that if you know, VoiceOver can handle it, and then it could pipe it out to another device that someone uses, so that you have really multi-coding. It's just like real life. If someone's moving around somewhere, there are multiple cues.
Multi-codable is an option, but something even simpler would be a specific haptic cue for a waypoint in your controller.
You're listening to Tech Tips on the North Carolina Reading Service.
We are talking with Gary Bartos and Matthew Schifrin about accessible gaming. And guys, you know, we have guidelines in place for the internet and that websites are supposed to follow to be more accessible. Are there guidelines in place for gaming, and what guidelines should companies use when designing their games to make them more accessible?
Ours.
Good answer.
Thank you.
There are accessibility tags that I know are being added by companies like Steam and Microsoft. And there are certain checks that games need to pass to be available on the PlayStation Store or whatever. Yeah. But how thorough those checks are and whether developers are beholden to them, I do not know.
A lot of these checks, it's great that they exist. It's better than nothing. And it's similar to if you submit an app to the Apple App Store, you know, there are certain automatic checks that take place and you have to pass those checks. Otherwise, your new app will not go through. So Matt and I can use different languages to describe this, but a lot of it is the way accessibility in gaming or improvements in accessibility take place is usually it's the, oh, we just made it barely accessible. Like it is provably more accessible. Like we did the thing, we changed the colors or something. We tweaked something a bit so it's more accessible. And that is great. But that is really only one improvement. And there are other improvements that should be made And not only that, but there are separate and distinct categories, each of which is a metric. Like you can actually measure whether you're making improvements, not just a pass fail, which can be problematic.
Just out of curiosity, is there a metric somewhere that tells us how many gamers are disabled?
If we Google, we know statistically, for example, that there is 7 million blind people in the U.S., and that's visual impairment, total blindness and partial. And then figuring out how many of those are gamers, I would know.
It's interesting because we have to start with the prevalence for visual impairment or any disability related to like print disability. But then you say the number can actually skew in either direction because, you know, in some sort of blindness adjacent interest or like disabled gamers and groups like that, is that there may actually be a higher percentage in the community than you might find elsewhere. It also means it would have to mean they have, you know, enough money and so on, but it may be higher, it may be lower. I think that's actually not known.
And I'm kind of curious for people who may not be into video games, is the term accessible gaming just for video games, or can it also apply to other types of games?
Absolutely, other types of games. Board games, role-playing games, all that.
Card games, chess, backgammon. You call those classic games. They're not really board games.
Yeah.
Culturally significant games, dominoes, that is a big one. That is a really, really big one. Mobile video games, which are different from console games. Matt mentioned role-playing games. And that even role-playing games, you know, would have spillover into other things. There are people who are into LARPing, right, which clearly spins out of role-playing games. Anything that's gaming, there's an accessibility element to it, or should be.
And one of the things I'd like to talk about is something you refer to as equity in gaming. And when I was doing my homework for this interview, I came across an acronym you had called SPOUT. And today I get the email and I noticed that you have since changed it to SPLAT.
See? So I'll provide the context and then turn it over to Matt, and then he and I can bounce back and forth on this. It is something that's changed a bit. So SPLAT. So it's SPLAT is the way I like to say it, with an exclamation mark. So it's an acronym. And so the types of equity in gaming. Equity in this case meaning, you know, an equivalent experience. So SPLAT, social equity, price equity. This one gets a little technical, load or label, get into that. Equity, actions, things you can do in the game in time, SPLAT. And it comes to like social equity. This is something that Matt does way better than I do.
Socially, when we talk about social equity, that means how easy is this to play for the disabled person? Not only that, but logistically, how easy? Let's say I want to go to a board gaming event somewhere. Okay, I can take a Lyft, get to the restaurant, that's fine. But then who are the people around me and how easy is it to play with them? Got to find the room, get in the room, figure out who the people are, figure out whether they're amenable to playing this thing, and then trying to figure out how easy is this kind of to play at speed.
And Matt was the one who talked about this in one of our presentations or talks, is that if one of the gamers is deaf or hard of hearing and you're around a gaming table, and there's just this socializing that takes place. But if the gamer who's deaf can't take part in that, for someone who's deaf, hard of hearing, we can even say someone who has some kind of communication barrier, just making sure they can come in, feel welcome, that there's a way for them to communicate. Could be they bring an app or they bring a piece of tech or something, or maybe they have someone who knows sign language, just to allow for that and to invite someone like this. The important thing is all of us to getting together. And yes, we're going to, the context is with the game, but we're going to figure something out.
And that's the social side of it. And I guess next is price equity.
Oh, price equity.
Uh-oh, I think I stepped in it.
The thing with price equity is board games are really, really, really expensive for blind people. There are companies who are doing wonderful work making board games accessible. 64-ounce Games, a wonderful company. But the trouble is because everything is handmade and hand-adapted and 3D printed, things are exceedingly expensive. Let's say I want to play Settlers of Catan, say a $15, $20 game. If I want to play that in an accessible version would cost $120 to $150. Blind people, a lot of them, just do not have that level of disposable income.
So one of the reasons I started my company was one of the big problems in accessibility, which people are becoming more aware of. There are more people who want to learn about accessibility. They just don't know where to start. In gaming, the same problem is in assistive technology. There are problems that, and these problems existed, and this is actually documented 50 plus years ago in a book called The Unseen Minority, where a lot of assistive tech is made essentially by hand or in small batches and is then delivered in some fashion to a tiny subset of what is a minority population. And as we know, there are these significant barriers to employment. There are generational problems that arise out of that. So when people have less disposable income, Matt mentioned, and then the technology or whatever it is developed in very, very small, non-mass produced ways, then it's more expensive for just a company to survive. It's expensive, and quite often, like if we're talking about tech for the blind, visually impaired community, we're talking about tech that's also developed largely by sighted people who initially don't know what they're doing. It's changing slowly, but they don't usually bring people who are blind in at the beginning of this. You know, they'll bring people in like Matt towards the end, at which point Matt and other people we know would be able to tell them, you know, in so many words, basically, this is fundamentally flawed.
Because not only is it fundamentally flawed, yeah, but this is a thing that we blind people did not absolutely, we didn't ask for it. We say, hey, we love your intention, yeah, but we do not need 7 different vibrating vests for navigational purposes. We just don't.
And you talking about Matt and his reviews reminded me of something my dad used to say all the time, and that is, if you don't tell me something is broken, I can't fix it. And that is what I think we as a blind and visually impaired community need to do more of. But don't just go to a company and say, hey, this product sucks. Come to them and say, hey, this product doesn't quite work. Here's why. Have you thought about trying this? Come to them with a solution.
Come to them with an idea and don't necessarily expect credit. That's sad, but you do that a few times, and so at some point you will meet someone who appreciates that. They'll come to you, and then they'll start asking questions earlier in the process. You'll start to have some influence on the process. Every little bit of influence is going to help some real people out there that you may never meet. Where the flaws creep in, it starts actually with just the ethical approach. Are we actually going to include blind people, not as just testers, but as part of the development group? In the earliest design phase, just what game should we make? Who has ideas?
Yeah.
All the way through production. But wherever you can start, just start there. Because I can say also as an app developer, the thing that is the hardest is getting feedback.
Lego's an example. I went to them and I said, hey, Lego, I made text-based building instructions so that blind kids can build these sets. Are you interested in doing that for some of your sets? Because I've been doing it all by my lonesome. And they said, sure. And now they're adapting 20 sets a year, and we at Bricks for the Blind, we're collaborating with them and we're doing other sets that they are not doing. Over 380 sets on our website.
That's incredible.
That is, yeah. He won't say it. He is the guy for Braille instruction sets for Lego.
And I had seen Bricks for the Blind in casual, general looking around, and that's you.
Yep.
It's Matt.
That's awesome.
If you ever want to build a Lego set or get into the hobby, I am your man.
I will definitely look you up if I get the urge for Lego, and I will definitely keep that in mind. Moving on to the next letter in SPLAT, we are now up to L, which, if I remember correctly, stands for load.
Load or labor. The technical terms, so these are sort of human factors terms. Cognitive load, which means the effort to think through something or to deal with something, like to process sensory input, that sort of things, like just basically how much effort your brain puts into something, and it's divided among different tasks. And then kinematic or physical load, which is the physical effort. So the L equal load or equitable load or equitable labor means the physical and mental effort to play a game. Reducing the physical load would mean something like if someone has limited mobility of their hand, well, what about bigger cards? Why aren't the cards a little bigger? Some of it's cost and so on. But are there bigger cards? Or can the person move the piece? It should be equal. Labor is probably an easier word to remember because it is effort.
A quick practical example. Let's say I'm playing Braille Scrabble with someone and I can read the letters and I'm trying to figure out what letter to play. I would need to feel the entire board to see which words are placed where. And that's going to take a lot of feeling, a lot of calculating, a lot of reading. Do I have problems reading the Braille? No. But A, not all blind people read Braille. And B, it's still difficult in trying to calculate exactly where to put the dang tile.
And it's funny how that brings back a memory for me of when I used to play video games in college. It was more of recognizing patterns and remembering what I needed to do rather than looking at what was going on the screen and reacting to it.
It's part of the sensory motor loop that if you can get to the point where you're reacting to patterns, chess is the same way. There are patterns. High-level players play by patterns. Learning these patterns and having the sensory feedback or some other feedback where if I do this, then this happens. If I do this, then this happens. If there's a barrier there, then the game is inaccessible. Like we're talking about a video game like Pac-Man. If you don't know that the ghosts are chasing you in a certain area in a certain pattern, you're not going to get very far in the game. You have to know how to move the Pac-Man character left, right, up, down at a certain time in anticipation of this pattern that if you're sighted, you're seeing.
Not only how to move him, but where to move him.
And it can be, it's like there's only a little bit left that Pac-Man has to waka, waka, waka. They have to go eat, and it's all the way on the other side of the board. But you have to run in an entirely different direction in order to come back around, or at least me, because I'm not that good at it. I'm better at Miss Pac-Man. But
you find the game that you like that worked well for you, and that was the game you stuck with.
Yeah, Chris, one last thing on this topic, because I think what you said was really important, just the notion that you find your game. This is related to accessible gaming, is that it's great if certain games are going to be universally accessible. This is going to take a while to get there. That only works when it's done by design, not after the fact. Like Mattel takes Uno and other games and they make them colorblind friendly. Then people who are colorblind now can play that game more easily. So they can find their games out of, we'll call it like this arcade of game possibilities. As long as different companies are improving certain games or designing certain games, then there's a whole community of gamers who are going to be really happy about that.
Due to time constraints, I was unable to air the rest of my conversation with Gary Bartos and Matthew Schifrin on this episode of Tech Tips. Our conversation on accessible gaming will conclude in next month's episode. In the meantime, if you would like to do some research on your own, visit audiogames.net. During our conversation, Matthew mentioned Bricks for the Blind. If you would like to learn more about that, visit bricksfortheblind.org. Gary's company is called Echobatics. You can visit him at echobatics.com. His email address is gary@echobatics.com. Echobatics is spelled E-C-H-O-B-A-T-I-X. I would like to thank Gary and Matthew for their time. It was greatly appreciated. Tune in next month for the rest of our conversation on accessible gaming. We've run out of time for this month's episode of Tech Tips. I hope you've enjoyed it. If there's something you'd like covered in a future episode, send an email to techtipspodcast@gmail.com. I'm Chris Skidmore for the North Carolina Reading Service. Tech Tips is available online by visiting our website at ncreadingservice.org. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. If you have questions or comments about the North Carolina Reading Service, visit us online at ncreadingservice.org or give us a call. Our telephone number is 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to Tech Tips on the North Carolina Reading Service.